This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure and honor to have with me right here in the studio the poet, short story writer, novelist, essayist, environmentalist, and farmer, Wendell Berry. His nonfiction includes The Unsettling of America, his poetry includes Sabbaths and the Mad Farmer poems, and his novels include Jaber Crow. His cover story for The Progressive a couple months back was entitled Inverting the Economic Order, and it's gotten an ecstatic response from our readers. Wendell Berry, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much, Matt.
How'd you become interested in being a writer?
I suppose when I was young, I wrote some love poetry, which is a kind of utilitarian verse, and I enjoyed doing that. But it seems to me that as I grew into maturity, it began to seem to me that I had stories to tell and things to say, and I liked writing. And more and more purpose, a greater sense of purpose grew upon me. And I think that made me an essayist as well as a fiction writer and a poet.
No, I understand your dad was a farmer and a lawyer, and how did he take to having his firstborn son want to be a writer, of all things?
Well, I know from the testimony of mutual friends that it worried my father to death, as it would have worried me to death had my son told me that he was going to be a writer. When my father finally became convinced that I was worthwhile as a writer, he became a very enthusiastic supporter of my work.
How did he become convinced of that?
Partly, I think it was because as an essayist, I took up his cause, which was the small farmers. My father worked in the tobacco program all his life, which, as he understood it, was a way of making a lot of small farmers solvent on small farms.
What's happened to small farmers? Why have they become almost extinct? Why are they an endangered species?
Well, that's complex. The simple explanation is that for the most part, farmers have had to sell their products at depressed prices and buy their operating equipment and pay their operating expenses at inflated prices, which means that they've been exploited. And over many years of such experience, a lot of farm young people have been advised by their families not to be farmers. There are other reasons, of course. A lot of people look down on farmers as though they are stupid, when in fact, to be a good farmer requires high intelligence and a high formal intelligence. But in the main, I think the small farmers have dwindled away because of the economic situation that they've been caught in. It's become harder and harder to make a living.
And the agribusiness giants, Wendell Berry, they They get the small farmer coming and going, don't they?
Yes. They take his product at the lowest, or take his or her product at the lowest possible price, and sell him their products at the highest possible price. Now, I think it would be wrong to stop at this point, because in fact, there is a counter movement at work in this country of I suppose we could call it local food economies, the development of local food economies, farmers markets, community-supported agriculture farms, and the growth of a sort of subpopulation that I think could be accurately called urban agrarians, people who are willing to support local producers. And this local food economy is helping a lot of small farmers to survive and do well.
How big is this local food movement, do you think?
Not big enough. It's still small, but it's growing at an astonishing rate, and I think it's destined to grow because the industrial food economy is proving itself over and over again to be untrustworthy. It can't really be depended on to deliver food that isn't toxic or food of the highest quality. And so we have this phenomenon of local food economies that are formed on the cooperative principle, namely cooperation between producers and consumers, which is unorthodox for our country and system, but it seems to me extraordinarily promising.
I'm speaking with Wendell Berry. Of course, he's the essayist and short story writer and poet and farmer in Kentucky. Why don't you read us a poem, if you would, Wendell Berry? This is a poem, one of your more recent poems. It just appeared in the New Yorker magazine not too long ago. Go ahead and introduce it and read it for us, if you would.
I had to have a short speech for the Garden Club of America. I think it was 10 or 12 minutes, and I decided that I would like to try to say something, and so I tried to pack as much as I could into a poem. This is called A Speech to the Garden Club of America, with thanks to Wes Jackson, and in memory of Sir Albert Howard and Stan Rowe. Thank you. I'm glad to know we're friends, of course. There are so many outcomes that are worse. But I must add, I'm sorry for getting here by a sustained explosion through the air, burning the world, in fact, to rise much higher than we should go. The world may end in fire, as prophesied. Our world, we speak of it as fuel while we burn it in our fit of temporary progress, digging up an antique, dark-held luster to corrupt the present light with smokes and smudges, poison to outlast time and shatter comprehension. Burning the world to live in it is wrong. As wrong as to make war to get along and be at peace, to falsify the land by sciences of greed, or by demand for food that's fast or cheap, to falsify the body's health and pleasure, don't ask why. But why not play it cool? Why not survive by nature's laws that still keep us alive? Let us enlighten then our earthly burdens by going back to school, this time in gardens that burn no hotter than the summer day. By birth and growth, ripeness, death and decay, by goods that bind us to all living things, life of our life, the garden lives and sings. The wheel of life, delight, the fact of wonder, contemporary light, work, sweat, and hunger, bring food to table, food to cellar shelves, a creature of the surface like ourselves. The garden lives by the immortal wheel that turns in place year after year to heal it whole. Unlike our economic pyre that draws from ancient rock a fossil fire, an anti-life of radiance and fume that burns as power and remains as doom. The garden delves no deeper than its roots and lifts no higher than its leaves and fruits.
That's Wendell Berry reading a recent poem of his called Speech to the Garden Club of America. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Delighted to have in the studio with me the poet, essayist, novelist, short story writer, farmer, environmental activist, Wendell Berry. A beautiful poem. A word came up, well, a couple words that stick in my mind, falsify, and this idea of progress. You've been writing about this idea of progress in one way or another for many years now. Why is the idea of progress a false idea?
The reason that I've been preoccupied with this idea of progress is the difficulty of getting anybody to come up with the net progress. We know when we're living our common sense life in our own common, ordinary homes, that everything has a cost. And for this progress that we so claim to believe in, there is no accounting of costs and no subtraction. My belief is that somewhere along the way, we Americans lost the gene for subtraction. We just keep adding and forgetting the rest.
Oh, and what needs to be subtracted?
The real cost of production. The Appalachian coal fields are now being destroyed, and that is to say the topsoil and the forests of the Appalachian coal fields are now being destroyed by a process of coal mining called mountaintop removal. But we have never, in the process of carrying out this destruction, tried to place a just value on the topsoil, the streams, and the forests that are being destroyed, let alone the peace of mind and the home places of the people. Those costs are not booked by the coal industry. So I want, as an obligation of justice to start with, to see those costs in some manner booked and subtracted from the profit. It seems to me that if those costs were accurately accounted, the profits and the progress would be very dramatically diminished, and we would be ashamed.
Hmm. Wendell Berry, you risked getting arrested on this very issue of mountaintop removal. You went to Washington, D.C., and I was surprised to see it because I didn't know you engaged in that kind of activism, at least not at this point. I knew you were actively opposed to the Vietnam War, for instance, and I know you oppose all wars for that matter. But what drove you to take that stance?
Well, I first witnessed strip mining. It was contour stripping in those days. Well, they just carved a notch out around the mountainside and let the overburden go wherever it would. But I began to oppose and write against surface mining in 1965. And the reason I wound up in Washington, I suppose, is that I made a speech in Frankfurt the February before advocating civil disobedience. And my argument was that the state government of Kentucky is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry, and that if the constituted government abdicates its responsibility to protect the land and the people, then that responsibility has to revert to the people. And my argument was that we would have to get in the government's way. And so I had opened my mouth in public in support of that possibility and have been ever since under obligation to do what I ask others to do. And that was why I was in Washington.
Are you going to be doing that again, do you think?
If the occasion arises, I'm going to be doing it again. If the Lord spares me and I keep my brains at work.
Wendell Berry may yet be a felon, although I don't think it's a felony what he's trying to do. He may get slapped with a charge of civil disturbing the peace or whatnot, whatever they throw you in jail.
We were trying not to be felonious. But.
I can't see it being a felon, actually, but... So, since 1965, been writing on some of these issues. That's 45 years, if my math is correct. And how far gone are we environmentally after looking at this for 40 years?
Well, it's very saddening and troubling to me to realize that when I was a boy growing up, we could swim without worry in any stream. We could drink out of wet weather springs. We could eat any fish we caught from any stream without any worry. And I don't think that there is an unpolluted stream in my state that's fit for swimming or that produces edible fish. In my lifetime, we've lost much topsoil. We've cut a lot of old-growth forest. So my grandchildren are living in a world that is really significantly diminished from the world that I inherited and grew up in. So I don't know how far gone we are. And I don't like the idea that we ought to figure that out before we do anything. There is something that is, for most people, instantly recognizable as destructive behavior. And as human beings, as responsible human beings, as parents and grandparents, we're obligated to get against destructive behavior.
And you've been writing about the destructive behavior not only of these coal companies that are destroying the environment, but in a sense, the destructiveness of the way of the entire economy, the destructive concept behind the economy. And what is this larger critique you're making of the economy as it's called now, or as it operates now?
Well, the economy as it operates now is strictly focused on production, and a just and true and sensible economy would have to accept its obligation to maintenance. There is a law that was identified by the British agriculturist Sir Albert Howard as the law of return. And this simply meant that the nutrients, the wealth that we take from nature, has to be returned to the place from which we took it. That's what I referred to in my poem as the wheel of life. It has to keep turning in place. We have disregarded that entirely, with the result that we're now in what I suppose you would call round two of original sin. Even if we wanted to be innocent of destroying the world, we couldn't be, because we're all complicit in this economy that is destroying it in our behalf.
And it's a economy based on production, and some of that production is of junk. I mean, you can produce anything.
Utterly worthless stuff that it is worthless and unnecessary when it's made and sold to us. And when we throw it away, it becomes substantially worse than nothing. These indestructible plastics and metals that, as garbage, are going to outlast anything made by the ancient civilizations.
Wendell Berry, you've also talked about a different kind of production that is even more bizarre, and that is the production of non-products, that is, production of financial, I don't know what you would call them, non-entities that are bought and sold and no one sees, and you can't eat them, you can't wear them. They're just buying and selling money or products or names given to money. And what's wrong with that?
Well, that is the financial system. And I have to be very careful in talking about this subject because I'm not an economist. I'm simply a man interested in economy, which is to say housekeeping, the way we live. And the idea that you could run an economy on non-products, commercial paper, futures, those things that don't have anything to do with any existing thing of value, any goods. And so my argument is that what we've done essentially is to turn money loose to prey upon goods. We're tearing down mountains in order to have money. And this is a bad trade.
You've also been writing against usury, which is a word that we don't often hear anymore, but ought to hear when we see the interest rates that people are charged for their credit cards, for instance, and these payday loans. Sometimes the interest rate is triple digits on some of those. Usury ought to be outlawed, used to be outlawed, I thought, and now is run rampant.
Well, Dante is my authority on usury. Dante understood that we are to live from our work and from nature. And to invent systems in which money can grow from money becomes a kind of blasphemy. And, of course, finally it becomes destructive of real value. But there's something deeply distressing and troubling about the idea that we could let our money work for us while we sit in idleness.
I mean, that's the expression, though. Put your money to work.
Put your money to work. And we've been taught to like that because we've been taught to despise work. And we have been taught that kind of spite against work without being taught to distinguish between good work and bad work.
And on top of that, the bankers and the CEOs are demanding these obscene salaries that are just astronomical, and the assumption is that they wouldn't work unless you're getting $5 million a year, when the rest of us, the nurses and the police officers, firefighters and teachers, are working, and many of them in a rewarding way, feeling rewarded by it.
Right. We depend every day on people whom we depend upon to work out of a sense of duty and commitment and a sense of service to other people. So this idea that you have to pay an exorbitant salary to college presidents, coaches of basketball teams and corporate CEOs before there'll be any account is just an insult to all these dutiful workers who work well simply because of pride in their work.
I'm speaking with Wendell Berry. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. We were proud to publish a poem of yours a couple years back, Wendell Berry, called Questionnaire. And if you wouldn't mind reading it for us, that would please me a lot.
I don't write all my poems from anger, but this is one written from anger. Questionnaire 1. How much poison are you willing to eat for the success of the free market and global trade? Please name your preferred poisons. 2. For the sake of goodness, how much evil are you willing to do? Fill in the following blanks with the names of your favorite evils and acts of hatred. 3. What sacrifices are you prepared to make for culture and civilization? Please list the monuments, shrines, and works of art you would most willingly destroy. 4. In the name of patriotism and the flag, how much of our beloved land are you willing to desecrate? List in the following spaces the mountains, rivers, towns, farms you could most readily do without. 5. State briefly the ideas, ideals, or hopes, the energy sources, the kinds of security for which you would kill a child. Name, please, the children whom you would be willing to kill.
That's Wendell Berry reading his poem Questionnaire, and he sounds a lot like Dostoevsky in that from Brothers Karamazov, who asked whether you, by saving humanity, would be willing to kill just one innocent baby. And the answer to that was no. You also talk about, in that poem Questionnaire, patriotism, flag, and you have what I would call an idiosyncratic definition of patriotism, not a flag saluting, an anthem singing one necessarily. How do you define or describe patriotism?
Love for your country.
But what is
the
love?
The country,
for you?
The land, the place. We justify a great deal of our aberrations and evils now by saying that we do them for the sake of survival. What my poem argues, I think, that if we have to become monsters in order to survive, we better just fold our hands and go on and make our exit.
Are we going to be able to survive this round two of original sin, as you put it?
Well, I don't know. The thing to do is not worry about whether we're going to survive or win or succeed. The thing to do is to find the work that needs to be done. And in the gentlest, least destructive possible way, go about doing it.
Well, that is the injunction of the day, to do the work, not knowing whether we'll succeed or not. And Wendell Berry, it's been an inspiration to have you with me in the studio today on Progressive Radio. It's an inspiration to have you in the Progressive Magazine. It's been a joy of my life to meet you. Thanks for being my guest.
Well, Matt, thank you. Likewise.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.